Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Welcome to the Generation Y podcast. Mike, please introduce yourself.
My professional name is Michael W. Street. I'm the author of Sketch Cop, Drawing a Line Against Crime. I'm a forensic artist and a retired police sergeant with over 30 years of experience in police investigations, police work, and forensic facial imaging.
And real quick, forensic facial imaging, for those who don't know, what is it?
That was a mouthful, yes. It's I take facial images and I correct them for the police in terms of facial identification purposes in the event that they have an unknown perpetrator that a witness will describe or an unknown murder victim who they're seeking the identity of. And of course, you know, forensic is just the tagline or the word that it gives it that scientific field. But I provide investigative support mostly for police detectives who are looking to identify people.
Whether they're a suspect or a deceased victim.
Absolutely. Whether they're an unsub, as the FBI likes to call them, or an unidentified homicide victim.
Okay. And before we really get into it, you've written a book, which I just finished reading, titled Sketch Cop. And how did you come about wanting to write this book?
My late wife had suggested it several years ago, and I didn't think for a minute about writing a book until she suggested it. And I kind of looked at her like she was crazy. And she said, well, look at your file cabinet. She said, you have cases that you've worked that have made headlines over the last few years. And I think it's something people would want to read about. So I started writing it. It was great therapy because she was going through chemotherapy at the time for her cancer and such. And so while she was recovering from her treatments, I would write. And then I found that the more I researched these cases, the more fascinating the stories became. Because even though I was involved in them from the artist standpoint, I had limited involvement. I knew enough about them, but when I started really digging into the dirty details, so to speak, I was even fascinated.
Yeah, it's amazing how a wife can give you advice and our instinct is not to go with it, but in the end, they're almost always correct.
You know what? Even my wife I'm married to now, she likes to always tell me that I'm correct, but in a lot of ways she's correct as well. And I think that women have very good instinct that more of us men should probably listen to.
That's right.
We don't want to wind up on the couch, of course, or somewhere else.
One of the first things I noticed, you bring up in the book
the Identikit, and the eFit. And the former is what it's known as in the United States of America, and the latter is how it's known in the UK. Can you give us a rundown of what these are?
Well, both of them were the predecessors to the software programs that we have today. And the Identikit was a box. It was a wooden box, actually, full of what they called foils, but they were small pieces of acetate that had codes on them and facial features. And the operator would sit down with the eyewitness, and they would select these parts, and they would overlay them, much like you'd be putting a puzzle together, and paperclip them together to come up with a face. So it was fairly primitive now, but then it was the hottest thing going. The eFit was the English version of that, same sort of principle, a series of parts that were connected and or overlaid together to come up with a suspect image.
So back in the day, this was the best way to be able to show a group of people, investigators or possible witnesses, here's what the suspect looked like, right?
Correct. And actually, for its time, it was the Identikit was invented, I believe, in the late 50s and saw a lot of wide use throughout the 60s and 70s. I mean, I remember when I came on the job in 1977, it was still around, but it was the best they could do. I mean, it was so primitive that if you wanted to put a beard or mustache on the person, they would supply a grease pencil for you to do that with. But at the time, it was the best thing going, and they actually did have some success with it.
Yeah, I like that. You could put the basics down, the type of eyes or the hair, but then all of a sudden you have this grease pencil and you can add a mole or a mustache.
Sure. And now with the software program that I created with my company, this program is called SketchCop FaceSet, and we sketched all those parts and drew those in there. So when the officers or the detectives put them together, it looked like an artist sketched it. And now, of course, with Photoshop and all the digital tools and stuff, it takes that grease pencil concept, and it's like on steroids. And it makes the image much more realistic looking and much more like what people expect a police sketch to look like.
Yeah, and it really struck me how being a sketch artist, you are an artist. So the more tools you have, the more you can customize this image and probably have greater success, right, in the field?
Yes, it's like I like to tell my clients, when you use this computer software and the tools that are available, and even when I use digital tools, it increases eyewitness satisfaction, therefore increasing the likelihood someone's going to be identified. Of course, there's no guarantees, but the happier the eyewitness or the victim is when they walk out the door, the better the opportunity to capture the crook, so to speak, and the digital tools allow us to do that.
Another question related to this, how did you get involved in sketching? Because it made me wonder if you had a background in art or if this was just something that you dedicated yourself to and had to start from the bottom.
I definitely started from the bottom. I mean, my background was in cartooning. I was like every kid that doodled and drew cartoons and wanted to be a Disney artist. That's how I started. I was the kid that would finish his lessons in school early and have the teacher come around and grab my pencil and paper because I was drawing police motorcycles. I was drawing everything but what I was supposed to be doing in class, I guess, even though I got good grades and finished my work always. So when it came time to choose a career, I mean, I knew that unless you created a niche for yourself somewhere, the average artist just wasn't making any money. It was the whole starving artist thing. So my father was a police officer, and there were always police officers around the house. I mean, all hours of the day and night. I mean, they were always around. And so I loved their stories. I loved helping people. I loved standing up to bullies and protecting those who couldn't defend themselves when I was in school. So I took that path into police work. Now, one night, I saw a television newscast, and they showed a composite on the screen, and that's when I had the epiphany. I'm like, that's it. That's how I can take my art and combine it with police work and have the best of both worlds. The problem was I wasn't a portrait artist by trade. So as you can see, like in the earlier chapters of the book, like the very first chapter, the sketch is very raw looking. You can see that there's some anatomy there. It looks like the beginnings of something good. But it took me several years to refine and train and get to where I was happy, where I considered myself a true, like, facial portrait artist.
And is there some certification for this trade, or is it just bring in a portfolio and show people, here's what I can do?
Well, there is certification through the International Association for Identification. There is a certification as in forensic art. There's a certification for many things, but the discipline of forensic art has its own. I am certified. But really, at the end of the day, it's really all about how you can communicate, because you could be the best artist in the world. You could be like Michelangelo, Rembrandt, Picasso, whoever. But if you can't connect with people, in the end, I would tell people, it's like, okay, certification, no certification, that's neither here nor there. Strong drawing skills are important, but even more important is the ability to connect with people. If you can't connect with someone and retrieve that information from their memory and put it on paper, then you might as well go down the boardwalk and draw portraits all day long. Because no amount of certification, no amount of education, no amount of artistic skills is going to give you that.
Right. And I imagine that your law enforcement background also helped with this.
You know, it did. But the thing is like when I first started, you know, I mentored under one of LAPD's famous artists, and, you know, he was a really good guy, and I just didn't get him. I mean, he's a fantastic artist. You know, I was hung up on the whole, you know, the who, what, why, when, where, and how type of questioning, the just the facts, ma'am, Joe Friday Dragnet type of interview. And so it was a rough start for me because I was used to speaking and dealing with people a certain way. And you can't deal with people who are the victims of traumatic crime the same way. So over time, I evolved and refined my interview style such where I got people really comfortable with me really fast and have come up with some really amazing work.
Yeah, but imagine if they're not comfortable, the stress of the situation can cause them to not pull up the information they need.
Well, just something as simple as wearing a uniform. Like when I first started doing this, I was assigned to patrol. So I was a patrol officer. So I came in and here I was sitting across the table from somebody. Not only did I have the table as a barrier between us, now here I am sitting there in this uniform, big shiny badge, gun. People hate coming to the police station in the first place. It's like going to the dentist's office, you know. Even if they're not in trouble, they hate going there. So if you have all these accoutrements and all the paraphernalia and you have this look of authority, people aren't really going to open up all that much. You know, it's some of my favorite police artists that, you know, had, you know, beards and they wore civilian clothes. They had this aura about them, this cool persona. And everyone has their own style and their own way of doing it. And I developed my own way in terms of how I decorated my office, how I approached people, how I greeted people to kind of set the stage for the interview and to come up with something that they would be happy with, something that would be useful for detectives.
One of the very first stories that you cover in the book, and it might be my favorite story that you convey to the reader, is about a man named Dwayne McKinney, and it had to do with a shooting at a Burger King. What can you tell us about this?
Well, it was one of my first cases, and I was actually working that night when a Burger King restaurant was robbed in the west end of our city. And it happened just as the shifts were changing and one group of officers were coming off duty and we were going on for our overnight shift. Person went in there, robbed the place, took it over, walked all the witnesses and the employees into a walk-in, went into the office, confronted the manager, got the money, and in short, executed this 22-year-old kid who had a wife that was home, pregnant with their first child. And it was just tragic. And so detectives had received information about some gang members in Los Angeles doing like jump in and or like gang ritualistic robberies and such. And so they received some photographs of some of these gang members and had found one that matched the composite. And they had some witnesses come in and identify them and had some other, you know, scant circumstantial evidence. And to make a long story short, this man, Dwayne McKinney, was convicted of the robbery and the murder of Walter Bell, who was the victim in this case. And he spent 19 years in prison, I believe, before information came through that exonerated him of the crime. And, you know, he was just real forgiving person. I mean, he had every reason to be angry at the world when he came out because, I mean, almost 20 years of his life was stolen from him. But he came out and he hit the Christian circle, was a real popular speaker, received a cash settlement, as he should. He's well-deserved from the city and the county, I believe, and the state. I mean, they give some of that compensation money. And so he didn't really know what to do with it. And he had a friend say, hey, look, you know, maybe you should invest in some ATMs. And so he went over to Hawaii and saw there were no ATMs over there, really. And he started looking at the tourist trade, started putting two and two together, and invested in a string of ATMs and became a millionaire. Had an oceanfront home in Hawaii. Really got up on his feet and recovered. And it was a great story. It had a really horrible beginning, but it had a great ending until the tragedy. The real tragedy came is when he was involved in an accident. He was riding a moped on the island there in Hawaii and was struck by a car and killed. And it was a real tragedy. And, you know, I felt bad because the guy lost, you know, a lot of his life. But it was one of those cases where he looked like the sketch. And what I didn't realize at the time when I was doing some research is that I actually did a second sketch in that case as well from another witness who looked like the person who eventually they figured that it probably was, but the public defender's office, you know, messed up the case to where they could never prosecute this person. So I've got one sketch that looks like Dwayne McKinney, the wrongfully convicted guy, one sketch that looks like the person who probably did it, who will never be brought to justice, who will never be prosecuted for it. So, I mean, I could jump up and say, well, I didn't put him in prison because, but the sketch was the very beginning of the chain of events that led to that.
Well, one of the things that a sketch can't quite convey, though, is height, right? And wasn't there about 3 inches difference between Dwayne McKinney and the man who probably did this, which was Raymond Jacket III?
There was a height discrepancy, and also you remember Dwayne McKinney also suffered a shotgun wound to his calf in a drive-by shooting in Los Angeles. Somebody tried to kill him, and so there was question whether he could even vault the counter like the witnesses described. So you had one eyewitness doctor expert against another. One said he could vault the counter, one said he probably couldn't vault the counter. If you read the story, you think, okay, well, there are some discrepancies, but there's a lot of similarities. And it was just one of those tragic cases where people had the best intentions, but at the same time, there are a lot of things that went horribly wrong. And it's like when people ask me, you know, what I think of eyewitness cases, and I think eyewitnesses are very good. But I think, you know, if somebody matches a composite sketch, you know, then the detective, it's up to the detective to do the due diligence and the research and try to corroborate that identification and or try to, you know, tie the person to more than just the sketch.
True. You provide one aspect of it and then the detectives have to work the rest of it. Another thing that struck me about this was Charles Hill, who met him early on in prison and then almost 20 years later met him again in prison and was willing to write a statement that would end up helping him get out.
I mean, he even wanted it notarized. He was that sure of it. And this is the thing. The information came in earlier, but again, slipped through the cracks. Somebody dropped the ball. You know, somebody dropped the ball in the public defender's office. So it wasn't just the prosecution side. It was the other side. And really, to the Orange County District Attorney's Office credit, and Tony Rakakis, who's currently the district attorney, they had every reason to drag their feet, but they didn't. You know, they got him out of jail right away and did the investigation and were willing to admit that a mistake was made and worked very hard to make it right.
Right. And credit to Charles Hill, who, like McKinney, had a criminal background, but still came through for somebody when he didn't have to.
He didn't have to. And this is the thing. I mean, over the course of my career and the course of my life, I've known plenty of people, you know, criminals, non-criminals, but, you know, a lot of criminals and such that, you know, I wouldn't invite them over to my house for dinner and give my home address, but that doesn't make them any less believable because they're behind bars or because they're a criminal. And somebody should have taken that information earlier on and gave it more credence instead of just like setting it aside and dropping the ball. Otherwise, you know, Dwayne might have been out of jail a lot sooner.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, With therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Now, another case, and I want to talk about this one because it highlights working with someone who most people wouldn't think would be able to give you a good description. And the case I'm talking about is 10-year-old Anthony Martinez, who was abducted in 1997.
You know, and that's one of those cases where children are eyewitnesses. I have no problem with children as eyewitnesses. I've had them as young as five, and in every instance, they've been very accurate. The Anthony Martinez case, you know, for your listeners, was a 10-year-old boy abducted about 20 feet from his front door. The only eyewitnesses were his 8-year-old brother and his 10-year-old cousin, and they witnessed the abduction, and they alerted the parents, and who in turn alerted the authorities, and they were able to provide me a very, very close a composite. Was a very, very close resemblance to the suspect, was ultimately arrested and is sitting on federal death row right now. But subsequent to that, the Samantha Runyon case described in the book, where the witness was 5 years old, and I have had a couple of other cases not in the book where the eyewitnesses were 5 years old, and they were remarkably accurate.
Yeah, in this Martinez case, you had said how there was a lot of pressure on you, especially the media, but possibly the detectives as well. They really wanted to move on this case.
They did. I mean, I received the phone call and rolled right away on it. And during the interview, I've got people coming in the door wanting the sketch. Like, you know, one of those things where you see someone tapping on their watch saying, come on, come on, come on. And it was really annoying. Not from the standpoint it was pressure on me. It quite frankly ticked me off, because I have very good friends in the news media, and the news media plays a tremendous role in helping the successful conclusion and or resolutions of these cases. But I tried to tell them, I said, look, I don't work for, you know, their deadlines. I mean, I work to get this right. And of course, that was before the internet really took off with social media and real-time type of transactions and such. But yeah, there's always a lot of pressure. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on any case, but particularly with children. I had a case the other day where I did three different sketches from three different witnesses on a high-pressure case where some guy was going around grabbing young girls on their way to school. Police departments feel the pressure to solve these cases, and anybody who has some sort of forensic expertise where they either A, have to examine some sort of evidence, or B, someone like myself has to interview the eyewitness to come up with a sketch. A lot of pressure. A lot of pressure.
You take your time to make sure that the sketch is as good and as accurate as you can make it. And then sometimes, like in the Martinez case, it ends up being useful in a way. But in a case like that, there are 4 or 5 years that go by before there's a real movement on the case where they finally can narrow down and zero in on a suspect.
Absolutely. I mean, that case went cold for a long time, number of years. And you know, some cases I've had resolved in less than a minute. I've had them go on, like the Anthony Martinez case, for about up to 8 years, I think it was, when he was finally arrested in conjunction with another crime. And there are some cases I've provided sketches for that have never been solved.
You get this sketch and you believe, to the best of your ability, this is the suspect, and you have no idea until later just how accurate your sketch is, right? Eventually you get the person who did it, the person who did it is arrested and prosecuted, and you can look at their photograph next to your sketch and compare them. And I know from your book, there have been some sketches that are just eerily similar to the person they end up catching.
And those are the best case scenarios. I mean, a lot of my peers will, you know, they'll tell you, you know, I've got so many what they call hits in the business. And my question to them is always, well, how many of them were as a result of the sketch versus DNA or a fingerprint? Like in, I've had cases where the sketch had absolutely nothing to do with solving the case, but yet the person still looked like the sketch and they captured him through DNA or fingerprint. And I've had other cases in the last 6 months. I had a case back in Baltimore where I provided a sketch in one case and a detective was investigating another one, a similar crime, a sexual assault. And somebody else says, yeah, it looks like I arrested that guy last week and provided detectives with a name. They got a DNA profile and matched him up to four cases. So it works both ways, but I would never be one to take credit for, you know, I'm always thrilled when it looks like the suspect. And quite honestly, at the end of the day, because what I provide is just a tool and I'm not really jumping up and down to take the credit, I'm always amazed myself still.
Yeah, it's your contribution.
It is. I had a great time, you know, running down crooks in the street, you know, chasing them on foot, chasing them in cars. You know, I always wanted to be able to do something different that set me apart and gave me an even further reach, and the ability to reach out and identify criminals and such. And this was my way of assisting my community, exploiting a skill I had, and being able to set myself apart from my peers and other people in the business.
What year did you really start doing this full time, and what year did you retire as a sergeant in the police force?
I took my first sketch training in January of 1980, I believe it was, late 79, early 80. I never did it full time. I mean, I did it as an ancillary duty, and then I moonlighted, so to speak, in my off hours for other local agencies that hired me to do it. I retired as a police sergeant in 2008, and it wasn't until 2011 when I was hired by the Baltimore Police Department to start up their forensic facial imaging unit in their crime laboratory and become their first full-time ever sketch artist.
So when you are a full-time sketch artist, are you a civilian at that point?
At that point, I was a civilian. I was hired as a civilian in the laboratory. And which was fine, you know. I'd already had enough, you know, running and gunning, chasing crooks down and stuff. So it was nice to be able to see it from the other side. But they provided me a lot of autonomy because it was a new program, and so my clients, who were the detectives, I wanted to make sure that they were happy. And I was living away from my family, so I had plenty of time. So I was working 24/7. When they call me in the middle of the night, call me on the weekends. And one case was more outrageous than the one before in terms of the circumstances and just the sheer violence.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure, because here you are with all this law enforcement experience, but then you retire and yet you find yourself back in a police station, essentially, right?
Yeah, kind of funny how that works, you know. But, you know, it's police work itself. When you're in a uniform or you're a detective or whatever, it's a young man's game. I always liken it to professional athletes. I mean, they've got a certain shelf life when they're at their peak. And, you know, it's getting more violent, and the demands physically and emotionally are much greater now than they ever were before. So when I had the chance to retire and get out with my mind and body still intact, it was different as a civilian. The pressure for me was to make sure that I could get to everybody that needed my help. I was like a kid in a candy store. I loved doing what I did. And as a matter of fact, I had a woman ask me one time, she said, "Don't you ever get tired of sitting here drawing all day?" I said, "No, I love to draw." I said, "But even more so," I said, "are all you fascinating people that come through my door?" I said, "Everyone has a story to tell." I mean, I interviewed people from opera singers to doctoral students, gang members, prostitute grandmothers. I mean, I've been choked nearly to death during an interview by a sexual assault victim. I mean, one guy limped in, had survived 9 stab wounds, but thought enough to, you know, come in and see me to describe his attacker. And just great stories, just, you know, fascinating people that I just absolutely fell in love with and just loved helping.
Yeah, that must be really satisfying knowing that you're there to assist and to help people who others are trying to victimize or harm.
For stupid things, for silly things. I mean, as long as I've been on this earth and as long as I've been in law enforcement, I've never, ever seen any good reason for these people to do what they do to each other. And sometimes it's just for the sheer, for just the hell of it, just because they could. It's certainly no way to treat another human being, that's for sure.
What is your most famous sketch, do you believe? A sketch that you drew related to a case that the audience would definitely know about or have a good chance of knowing about, given their interest in true crime?
If you're in Southern California and you keep track of these things, even nationwide, I would say the Samantha Runyon abduction and murder. That case made national, international headlines back in 2002. And, you know, here she was, 5 years old, playing with her 5-year-old playmate in an alley, was abducted by a total stranger, raped and murdered, body dumped out near my home here, actually. That was the case that had news trucks lined up in front of my house for 2 days. And everybody wanted to know how I came up with this astonishingly accurate sketch from a 5-year-old, because nobody believes 5-year-olds. And then on the flip side, in terms of other cases, I was working with America's Most Wanted back in the late 90s, helping them promote a facial composite software product. And they sent me down to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to do a sketch of who would later become known as the Baton Rouge serial killer, Derek Lee Todd. And he was killing college co-eds and other women back in the 90s.
Another case that is covered in your book that, frankly, it was pretty surprising. We have this idea in our head, and I know you work to dispel this idea in the book, but we have this idea that criminals sort of look a certain way, they act a certain way, but there's a case that you cover where the criminal is someone most people wouldn't expect, and that's the murder of Janie Pang.
Yes.
And she was married to Danny Pang. She used to be an exotic dancer. And there was a day where she's at home and the housekeeper answers the door and the person at the door looks very professional looking and asks to come in to see Janie. Can you take us through this bizarre case?
Sure. It happened in Villa Park, California, which is a wealthy enclave in Orange County, 10,000 people. It sits right in the heart of the city of Orange. The city of Orange, where I policed, was just kind of wrapped itself around this city. Very wealthy people, professional sports athletes live there. And so this woman Janie Pang, the victim, who was once an exotic dancer, she married Danny Pang, who was an investment entrepreneur and seemingly had a great life, had a couple kids. You know, she rollerbladed, tended to her garden, and, you know, had the life. And one day there's a knock at the door, and the housekeeper answers and invites this person in. And next thing you know, he pulls a gun out of his briefcase and starts chasing everybody around the house and chases Janie upstairs. And she goes in a closet and tries to close the closet door. And the guy fires one round through the closet, hits her in the chest, kills her instantly. I was called to do a sketch in that case. And it turns out that they had somehow focused on Danny Pang's lawyer, who he owed some money. And so they figured that he was the most likely suspect. People said, yeah, that the drawing strongly resembles him. The hairstyle is very distinct. And they figured he wore a fake mustache because he typically didn't have a mustache. And so about the time the police were looking for him, he'd staged his own suicide. And what had happened was, he went on the run for 4 years and, you know, living the life of a fugitive. When they finally caught up to him, they arrested him for the murder and took him to trial. And he was acquitted by the jury. And that was pretty much the end of it. There was really nothing done on the case afterwards because he was the only suspect at the time. And of course, you know, the defense was doing their job, and their job is to bring up reasonable doubt. And they start, you know, telling stories about how Danny Pang was involved with this, these Chinese triads and organized crime and such, and owed everybody money. And it's really kind of interesting because I had contact with him later on after he married another woman, and she was involved in an auto accident, and he had responded to the scene. And then later on, of course, he died himself. But you know, there's still this mystery, you know, who killed her. And so the suspect in this case, a lawyer, would be the last person you would think would commit a crime like this. And he looked like a lawyer. I mean, if you look at this picture in the book, you'd never guess this guy could harm anybody.
Especially in the way that he pursued her through the house.
It's pretty manic. I mean, the behavior was he was pretty determined. And then, of course, you know, there were other allegations that she had a stalker. And, of course, the police were able to verify he was out of the country at the time. So, you know, and again, it's I don't know whether this person's guilty or not. All I know is that, you know, the police had the evidence. The sketch looked a lot like him, very much like him. And they took it to trial. And really, the defense didn't have to prove he didn't do it. They had to create reasonable doubt. So if the jury didn't necessarily believe he did it, and they didn't have to have any belief on who did it, just the fact that there's some reasonable doubt whether he did it or not. Once they acquit him, double jeopardy applies. And even if he jumped up, nah, fooled you all, yeah, I did it. You can't prosecute him. It's done. We'll never know. You look at the sketch, yeah, he did it. You look at the circumstance, yeah, he did it. But will we ever know? We don't know. It's one of the great mysteries in the book.
Right. And it's also a mystery about Janie's husband, Danny, because they ruled it a suicide. How do you take that situation? Do you believe he committed suicide, or was it something else?
Boy, you know what? I don't know. I mean, there's so many things that look like suicide, and people just, you know, mix their pills the wrong way. And my guess is that, you know, there were some allegations of some fraud and some financial mismanagement, and you know, it could have been that the walls were closing in around him. I don't know enough about his latter life after the murder and such to be able to formulate an opinion about looking at all the evidence. But, you know, yeah, he could. I mean, it's possible that he could have taken his own life to avoid everything that was crashing down around him financially and personally. Or it could have been the other. I don't know. We all like to believe, you know, these nefarious theories, these, you know, theories about how what happens and why things happen and stuff like that. And again, absent a suicide note, you have people in this half of the room saying committed suicide. People in the other half of the room is going to say, I think he just like mixed his pills or it was an accident. So who really knows?
Is there a sketch artist that is either working now or had worked in the past that you would say is the best sketch artist you know of? This is the guy that I always held as the top sketch artist.
I have three people, actually, for different reasons, and they're talked about in the book. I mean, I think that Fernando Ponce, who's the LAPD's artist, I think he taught me a lot about work ethic, you know, and working hard to be able to achieve your goals and achieve a level of excellence where people would recognize you. And I always tell my kids, you know, if you're really good at what you do, no matter what it is, work will come looking for you. You don't have to go looking for work. Horace Hefner, who worked for the FBI for a number of years, who drew the sketch of James Earl Ray, the alleged assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King, he taught me a lot about humility and the importance of the work, but always, you know, staying true to yourself and not taking too much credit for the successes, because it's really all about the victims and the witnesses. And Tom Macris, who's highlighted in the book, very soulful, very laid-back individual who he really got it. He was all about, you know, the technique, and he was all about, you know, creating this atmosphere and believing in your intuition and believing in your gut. And I mean, I think if you combined all those three together, they all had a baby together, so to speak, as the joke goes, you know, it would be the perfect sketch artist. But I know they didn't answer your question. You want me to pick one, but it's just hard to pick one. Those three, out of all the artists I've known and worked with over the year, those three are the ones that were the most important to me for those reasons.
No, if you have three rather than one, it's not that rigid of a question. It's just usually people can name one. If you have three, that's great.
Yeah, and I have three for very different reasons. They were there at the very beginning of my career, and they left an indelible impression on me just by their different personal traits that they had and how they approached the job and how they approached people. All three were very, very good with people, because at the end of the day, you cannot do this. I cannot emphasize enough that you cannot do this job with people, without people. And you don't want to inject yourself too much. I mean, I think what happens is that sometimes people get so hung up on their art. They'll get so focused on creating this beautiful picture, so anatomically correct. And I know memory doesn't work that way, where it's that exact, where people remember that much. So I think when you start injecting too much of yourself into the drawing, you start losing your way and forget that it's about the person and not about you.
So they can almost fill in any gaps or make adjustments as they look at the sketch. They'll think of the suspect.
Well, that's the idea. The eyewitness looks at the sketch and they can discern immediately what's wrong with it, what's right with it. And I always give people the admonishment that, hey, look, you know what? I'm working for you today. This isn't about me. If I wanted to, you know, sit and draw pictures all day of people's faces, I'd go get a job at Disneyland. But because this is about justice, it's about justice for you, you taking part in the criminal justice system. We create this synergistic relationship where it's your eyes, my hands, and we come up with something happy. If you don't like it, and pardon my French, but you know, if it sucks, just tell me how to fix it. You can criticize it all you want. I've got a really thick skin. I won't get offended. Just tell me how to fix it. And we create these great relationships, this great synergy and stuff. And they'll come through the door initially sometimes and say, I don't know if I can help. And within an hour or so, they're like, wow, I didn't even know I could do that. And you get them talking, they forget about why they're there. And they get relaxed and they start communicating. I mean, if you're in a room with you, they'll scoot their chair closer and start looking at the paper and start really, you can start seeing the change, how they come in really uptight. And if you do your job right, you're just shucking and jiving. You got this great conversation going and it just works out wonderfully.
The audience might not forgive me if I don't ask this question, but you're familiar with the Stephen Avery case, right?
Yes.
Now, in that case, early on in the documentary, they talk about this sketch that's done that's supposed to be of this man who raped this woman. Mm-hmm. And they end up arresting Stephen Avery for the crime, although later on DNA reveals that it wasn't Stephen Avery. It was another man named Gregory Allen.
Okay.
Have you looked at the sketch that was drawn, and have you looked into the similarities of that sketch and another picture of Stephen Avery?
I have not, but I know I heard there were allegations of the sketch being drawn from like a mugshot of somebody or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there might have been some tampering with the evidence or something in terms of the sketch itself. And that's nothing new. That's happened in other cases where the sketch looks so remarkably close and almost looks like they copied a mugshot. So if you told me that's what somebody did, I wouldn't be surprised because it's happened before.
You say it's happened before. Do you mean on purpose or by accident?
On purpose.
Okay. There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts, and when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
That's one thing that people wonder about is, could this happen? And of course, the man who was the sketch artist, when he's asked about this, he said how proud he was of this sketch. It was his first sketch that actually became news. So he was very proud of it.
Yeah, that would be interesting to hear the explanation. And you know what? This is the thing. Nobody's going to back up and say, yeah, I was told to do this by so-and-so. You know, there was a Philadelphia mob-related case that happened years ago. Same sort of thing. This person looked remarkably like a mugshot of this person who's ID'd. And it came out later that that's exactly what happened. So did it happen to Stephen Avery case? Again, unless somebody jumps up and says, yeah, I did it and I was forced to do it, I was told to do it or else, you can speculate and conjecture all day long. And maybe he was that good his first time out. I mean, you know what? It's like the McKinney case. That was one of my first big cases too. And I was really, artists are proud of their work. But I always rack my brain trying to figure out how I could have done better. And if anybody would ask me, say, hey, look, you know what, we want you to, you know, draw this person as who we think it is. Here's a mugshot. Just create this dummy composite. That'd be the day I got out of the business.
This book has something very interesting toward the end of it. And I believe it's just beyond the chapters where you talk about these other sketch artists. But at the very end of the book, you lay out safety tips for people. As I was reading through them, some of them seem kind of obvious, but just having these lists in the back of the book, I think, is a good enough reason for people who are worried about personal safety. It's another reason to buy the book. And how did you end up deciding to put these in there? Is that your law enforcement side coming through and saying, I want to put a little something extra into this book for people?
You know, I really care about people. I really do. And I thought it was a fitting way to end the book, saying, hey, you know what? This is how you can avoid getting in front of a sketch artist. But if you have to get in front of a sketch artist, and later on in the chapter, it talks about how to become a better eyewitness. But if you have to get in front of a sketch artist, then this is some things you may want to remember in terms of eyewitness identification. It seems obvious, and I even stayed in there, you know, these things may be obvious to you, but they're good reminders to reinforce. I'm not going to guarantee that following these will make you safe. You may be able to think of some other things. But really, when you talk about these things seem obvious, they do, and they are. But wouldn't you agree that walking down the street and looking down at your cell phone while walking is not a smart thing to do?
Right. And that's why I think the reminders are so helpful, because we're not always thinking about our personal safety. It sounds crazy, but we aren't. And the only way we can make ourselves safer is not just by knowing what we're supposed to do, but it's by repetition. Just as a good police officer will practice firearms training on a regular basis, a person who's worried about their personal safety should be reviewing the steps they need to take when they're walking to their car at night or walking down the street or getting ready to leave or enter their house. Unless you're thinking about these things often enough, they will slip your mind, especially in a stress situation.
That's why we engage in repetitive training. I can tell you, even I've been retired, oh my goodness, going on 8 years now. And I still, when I can, when I go into a restaurant, I sit with my back to the wall so I can have a clear view of the entrance. And when I was on the job, it would drive my wife crazy, because I would sit there in a restaurant, we'd be eating and she'd be talking. I'd be looking around. She'd be thinking, I wasn't listening to her. I said, I hear every word you're saying, but I'm busy scanning the room because that's what I'm trained to do. Now, I go back to the example of the cell phones. Everyone knows you shouldn't text while driving or walk down the street and pay attention to your phone. But yet, every day in traffic, you're sitting there at a light and there's someone texting going down the road. And they're risking death and injury, not only themselves, but other people. And no matter how many PSAs tell us not to do it, there are still people thinking it's not going to be them.
Before we finish here, let's talk a little bit about your publishing company that you're a part of. You released your book through Wild Blue Press.
Wild Blue Press, yes.
Yes, and we've had guests on from Wild Blue Press before, John Farrick and Steve Jackson, of course. And how did you come to release a book through Wild Blue Press?
Well, I was looking for a publisher that understood the genre of true crime and understood what it took to make a book like that successful in its particular genre, its particular market. And so I read a lot about, you know, Steve and some of the authors that they had signed to Wild Blue Press. And I thought, what a great group. What a privilege to be part of this group. They're already all established authors in true crime. And so I went ahead and contacted Steve and submitted some writing samples, and we communicated and such, and they felt that the material I had and that my perspective and background was a great fit for their company, and they've been great to work with. They've done a great job editing and designing the book and marketing it and such, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I can imagine you probably get along pretty well with Steve.
He's very good. He's a good guy, and he's a great mentor. He knows the business, and they've got great editors that know how to make a story flow and keep the energy going. And I think that was one thing I learned about, you know, in publishing this book, was the value of a good editor. You can't even talk about writing a book without having a good editor. And I'm privileged that I'm able to be part of a group and not have to self-publish. I mean, no knock on the people who are self-publishing. I think it's great. You might have that kind of control over a book. But when you start talking about publishing and being with publishing companies and dealing with editors and book cover designers and social media directors and stuff like that, it can become overwhelming. And I would rather focus on developing the stories and writing more stories and leaving the rest to somebody else.
So where can people find your book, Sketch Cop?
They can find it. Probably the easiest place is to go to Amazon.com. There's a Kindle version available, as well as a trade paperback version available. You can also buy it through Wild Blue Press. But those are the two places that immediately come to mind. Of course, you can get anything on Amazon, so I just instantly send people to Amazon.com. But I think, for anyone who's interested in what a sketch artist does, because people see these sketches, these images all the time. And I just wanted to kind of rip the veil off of the process itself and what it takes to go into a sketch. And of course, at the same time, I thought that these cases were so fascinating in terms of the challenges I face as a sketch artist, but the overall circumstance of the case, from the very first gunshot fired to the jail door slamming, I thought it was worth spending, a significant number of pages on each chapter to fully explain and delve into the cases and such, because really that's what people want.
Right. And the book does a great job of explaining the history of forensic facial imaging and giving some stories related to your sketch work, as well as some of the other sketch artists out there. So for anybody wondering, what is the book like? Trust me, there's a good variety of stories and information in it. I really doubt anybody would have anything less than a positive experience reading the book.
There's a lot of sketch artists out there. A lot of people doing some great work. I was looking at my statistics today I'm averaging over the last, 4 or 5 years, I'm averaging over 100 sketches a year. And they range in cases from, simple assaults all the way to, horrific murders and such. And of course, that doesn't make me better than the next person. But what it does is it gives me a special insight into the field itself and what it takes to become successful at it. And of course, being one of the busiest ones in the country, gives me availability to these cases and just makes sure that, for people who like reading my stuff, that there's going to be more books coming out.
And it's a bit of a niche market, isn't it?
It is. It is. And then, not only do I have the books, but also if you go to my website, sketchcop.com, you'll see that, the software I sell, the training I do for law enforcement, I'm into facial biometric imaging now with, pose correction software for facial recognition systems. And I do facial reconstructions. And most recently, I was on the History Channel show, Alcatraz Search for the Truth, where Frank Morris and the Anglin brothers escaped from Alcatraz in 1962, and they were presumed drowned in the San Francisco Bay. And the family recently came up with some photographs taken of the two brothers, the Anglin brothers, in the 1970s, allegedly South America, and I helped break the case wide open again when I looked at the pictures and did analysis and determined that it was more than likely that they had in fact survived their trip across the bay and could be in fact living abroad. So I do a whole bunch of different things in addition to, you know, doing composite sketches and writing books and stuff like that. But again, because of my involvement, it is a niche industry. I just keep, like I said, I just keep collecting these stories that I'm just anxious and excited to share in the future with the readers.
And do you have a book upcoming that you can talk about, or is it under wraps for now?
I have a textbook coming out, you know, later this year, early next year, for another company. But I do have another book that'll be in the pipeline in the next year with Wild Blue Press, involving one of the cases in the book, but in an expanded format. Really delving into the case, really taking that chapter and expanding it into its own book, and just really just breaking it down, looking at all the evidence and all the intricacies of the case and such. And we haven't really put it all together yet. The manuscript's completed, but it's just going to be a really exciting story, and I think it's one that people will enjoy. So hopefully we'll be announcing something about it soon.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming onto the show. And
it was my pleasure.
Best of luck to you, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. And like I say, go to my author's page at Wild Blue Press and or go to my website at sketchcop.com. And of course, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. I mean, I'm all on all the social media platforms and stuff. Just kind of keep track of what I'm doing and wait for the next book.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.